Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This season, prepare for every season with the Allbirds Mizzle Collection. These shoes were made for adventures in rain, shine, mist, or snow. Go to allbirds.com and use code FRESHSOCKS for a free pair of socks with purchase.
Across the UK, online, on DAB, and on your smart speaker, the independent republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
Good morning and welcome to the Independent Republic of Mike Graham right here on Talk Radio. As the day begins for most people who have nothing to do, we are here to keep you company, to keep you updated and to keep you informed with all the latest news from the lockdown and the corona fight back. This morning we'll have the first cabinet meeting of the week. Well, not we will, but the cabinet will actually, as you know. And it is a genuine first because every single minister is dialing in from a separate location. We'll be checking in with our political correspondent Charlotte Ivers to find out what's likely to come out of it. And we'll be bringing you the latest news from Downing Street on all of the people that are currently suffering from the coronavirus. Also, we'll be hearing from former Brexit Party MEP Alex Phillips on her journey back to the UK from Brussels, getting out just in time, and why she thinks she may have had the coronavirus when she lost all sense of taste and smell, something that many people are now reporting to have suffered. And we'll be checking in on what the latest guidance is that's being given to the police after accusations that they're being a little overzealous by handing out fines to people for buying Easter eggs or other non-essential items at the shops. Most of all, as ever, we want to hear from all of you out there. Your calls are informative, interesting, and always required listening. What you know needs to be shared with the outside world. So do please call us and tell us what you're seeing, what you're hearing, what you're being told, and what your employers are doing for you as well. 0344 499 1000. I'm delighted to say that after we reported yesterday that one of the big banks was making people work in an office because they didn't have enough laptops, that situation seems to have been fixed in that particular place. And also, of course, we talked about Billy Joe Saunders yesterday, shortly after I said he should have his licence revoked. Guess what? His licence was revoked. We have some great winners here at the Independent Republic of Mike Graham. If you want something done, come to me. And just call us, even if you just want someone to talk to. Coming up later on, we'll be talking to the co-founder of Greenpeace and now anti-climate change campaigner, Patrick Moore. We'll ask him what he makes of the coronavirus situation, plus what he makes of the eco-planks, who are now claiming that they've won the day because nobody's flying anywhere anymore. Plus, on our homeschooling section, it's all about history and how this country dealt with the bubonic plague. We'll be paying a visit to a place called the Village of the Damned. 0344 499 1000. And as usual, of course, we're streaming live on YouTube, on Facebook and on Twitter. You can now watch us as well as listening. And you are listening to me, Mike Graham, right here on the fastest growing radio station on the planet. It is, of course, Talk Radio.
Mid-morning with Mike Graham. Talk Radio.
Now, it does seem to be a long time ago, in that dim and distant past towards the end of last year, when we were thrust into what can only be described as stalemate before the election in December the 12th, when we didn't know if we were leaving the European Union or not, we didn't know whether we had a government or not, we didn't know if we'd ever do anything meaningful again or not. And in those days, we used to talk to Alex Phillips an awful lot, who was a Brexit Party MEP over in Brussels. She's now back in this country, repatriated without the aid of a governmental jet. And we're going to talk to her now live from Gloucester. Alex, a very good morning to you.
Good morning to you.
Thank you very much for joining us. Now, how long have you been back? Because we should have got you on before this. I can't believe it's taken us this long to track you down.
I know. I think it's probably about, two weeks ago I got back.
Is that right?
All the days sort of bleed into one.
They
I'm
do,
not
don't
sure
they?
Anymore.
Yeah, they do. But you had quite a fascinating journey back, didn't you? Because you got out just as they were kind of locking down Brussels.
Yeah, well, the weird thing is, even about the last time I actually saw you was 3 weeks ago tomorrow.
Yeah.
And even at that time, you know, we met up on College Green, we did PMQs, I was taking the London Underground.
Yeah.
It was before we really understood how severe this crisis was going to be, but that feels like months ago now.
I know, it does, doesn't it? I mean, even simple things. You know, I was saying to somebody the other day, I got very excited last week because I managed to find a shop that had some rice. You know, and I mean, you know, I used to get a lot more excited about a lot more interesting things, but we're living a much simpler kind of life at the moment.
Yeah, we are. Do you know, is it wrong to say I'm kind of enjoying it? I hope there are people out there in the country listening to your show who are sort of nodding, going, yeah, do you know what? I'm enjoying it too. Mm. It's not doom and gloom for everyone.
No, I absolutely couldn't agree more. I mean, certainly London without people on the streets is a far more pleasant place to be than when you're having to dodge people every time you walk anywhere. But tell us about how you got out of Brussels, because you escaped with your cat, I believe.
Yeah, well, it was a week after I'd been in London. When I got back from London, I thought, do you know what? I think I'll probably get out of Brussels now, a month early, before my lease is up, just in case they start closing the borders. And that was the time everything started setting in motion so quickly. So I was watching the news updates, not just from the UK, but from France and Belgium every single day, right, to see if they'd put restrictions on travel, closed borders. And it was really on a knife edge. We were sort of living by the hour. And because I was packing up my flat, I needed to convey things home in a van. Right. Not just, I've got a tiny little two-seater car, which is not really much good for a house move. So my lovely father, who used to be a lorry driver, offered to drive a van over from the UK, pick me up with all my stuff and bring me back to the Shire. And it was the Wednesday that we'd organised the van and booked the Euro Channel. He turned up at the borders and the French police wouldn't let him on the train.
Oh, God.
They said, no way, no how, picking up your daughter's not an essential trip, you're not coming into the country. So, being intrepid as he is, he decided it was the perfect moment to put his skills of negotiations in French to the test, drove around to Dover and managed to blag his way onto a ferry by telling them that I was on the street surrounded by boxes and would be effectively homeless if he couldn't get me into the van, which was a bit of a...
But so they were locked down in that way that we are now, long before we were, I guess.
A week before, which in COVID time is a long time.
Yeah, well, you say that, but actually it really is, because, with each week that goes past, I mean, even a week ago, we were less kind of locked down than we are now. And, I haven't been back to Sussex to see my kids because I just feel as though it's the wrong time to go that sort of distance in case something goes wrong.
Well, you probably wouldn't be allowed to. They'd ask you, is it essential travel? Should you be mixing with people who aren't,
permanently
in your household?
Yeah.
So, actually, be breaking the law, Mike.
Well, I do have a key workers card, though. So, I mean, technically, I do live there as well part of the time. So, in the end, that could be the case. But never mind that. So where are you now? What are you doing?
Well, I decided to come back to lovely Gloucestershire because I thought someone's got to keep my parents in check and make sure they stay fit and healthy for all of this. So I've actually, at the grand old age of 36, moved back in to home, but I'm basically private chef and personal trainer.
Very nice.
So I think they've got a good deal out of me. I'm cooking healthy food every night. I'm forcing my mum to power walk for an hour every day. We're doing yoga in the back garden. It's quite nice, actually.
That's all right. And are you able to get enough food at the moment down there?
Yeah, it's not so bad. I mean, my parents, being the old school people that they are, have had a milkman for as long as I've been alive, so he's still doing his rounds. But the annoying thing is, my mum's been grumbling because she says, I've been a customer of Milk and More as the company for all my life, basically, and now I can't get eggs because other people have signed up and they're using the milkman too. But no, it's not too bad. Eggs at one point were in short supply, but the trick is, and I shouldn't tell this to the entire nation, but it's about getting up early and going to the shop, first.
Well, I must admit, I'm sure it's much less difficult outside of London than it is here, because where I am, every time I drive into work, I drive past about three or four supermarkets and there's queues of people already outside waiting for them to open up.
Yeah, I mean, we've had some queues here, but that's where you have to stand sort of, 2 metres apart or whatever it is. But it's very civilised back home in Gloucester, certainly in the bit of Gloucester that I'm in. Everyone's obeying the rules. When we go out for our little power walk and around the local duck pond, you walk down the bit of pavement, see someone else coming, and someone will veer off onto the grass verge, and everyone says good morning and smiles, and it's I think following the rules to the letter of the law.
I think people definitely are. And that is a big change, actually, from this time last week, because when this all began, this kind of lockdown, people, I think, weren't particularly sure how to do that, and still aren't. There's still sort of pockets of stories that you see of people going out and having karaoke parties or things that they really shouldn't be doing. But the other bit that's difficult for me as well, reading the papers this morning, is the police not being quite sure, and we're going to talk about this later on the show, what essential goods are and whether you should be buying Easter eggs or hot cross buns. I mean, surely the point is you should be able to do that.
Well, this is the difficulty. Very, very stringent rules have been put in place very rapidly without much forethought to how they'll actually impact people. And a primary example of that is Sadiq Khan closing down half the tube services and actually funneling people all into the same carriages as a result. And I suppose the same thing happened when my dad tried to cross the border into France on the Euro Channel, and they said no. Instead of being on a mode of transport where he'd be sitting in his van completely isolated, it forced him to take a ferry where he has to park up the van and go mingle with hundreds of other people in a communal space. So I think if people actually looked at especially things like logistics with a bit of logic and not just, you know, put in place huge travel impositions, we can actually work out a system that suits everybody. And my main concern, and my heart goes out to people, especially in places like London, who live in tower blocks, who don't have back gardens. There must be a way that we can organise, even if it's on a street-by-street, tower-block-by-tower-block basis, you know, floor-by-floor, apartment-by-apartment, people to get outside and go and use public parks without having to uniformly shut them all down.
Yes, I suppose the difficulty for the government is that they're trying very hard not to be too authoritarian, and by that virtue they have to let people kind of figure some things out for themselves. But that's not always the best way to go at this point, is it?
No, and it is confusing. You know, back home in Gloucestershire, we're surrounded by gorgeous countryside, and I would love to be able to drive my car to the Malverns, the Cotswolds, and go out on a yomp. And I would follow every rule. If I saw people, I would make sure I completely distanced myself from them. But it's good for people's physical well-being and you know, psychological well-being to get out into nature. So I think we need to rethink this at some point down the line and come up with ways we can actually, well, police seems like a stringent word, but monitor and control people's use of the natural environment without having to ban people from using it altogether.
No, right. And what about your little run in with the coronavirus, because I saw that you had an issue with losing your sense of taste and smell, which I've now been reading is a definite symptom in some cases.
Well, yeah, you know, this was weird. It was actually, I had it the last time I saw you, and I can remember being on air and someone writing on Twitter, "Alex, you sound really snuffly." I had this sense of really bad congestion at the top of my nose, but without any sort of mucus. I felt this pressure in my sinuses, and I was headachy, I was lethargic, I had a bit of a tickly cough, not much of one. I felt run down, to be honest. I put it down to maybe a bit of seasonal lurgy and being exhausted, you know, recovering from the whole Brexit stuff. but the weirdest thing was I couldn't taste or smell a thing. Now, I've had colds before where you lose your sense of taste and smell. You can still just about taste some things, but you don't enjoy your food as much.
Right.
This was absolute. It was so
exciting. So you literally couldn't taste anything at all?
Nothing. When I got back to Brussels, I had a few days on my sofa feeling pretty rotten, living on paracetamol. And I was actually conducting kitchen experiments. I was putting raw garlic in my nostrils. I was putting salt and vinegar on my tongue. And I started Googling because I was so concerned by how absolute this was. I thought I must be having some sort of neurological episode.
Yeah, or a stroke or something.
Well, exactly. Yeah. It wasn't normal. Anyway, about a week later, the friend I'd stayed with in London called me up and said, I've had exactly the same thing. I'm going through it now. I can't taste or smell anything. I don't feel very well. I've got a bit of a temperature and a headache, but that's about it. And he said, I think you gave me coronavirus. And I said, oh, don't be stupid. I didn't believe him at all. And then, since that moment, a lot of information has emerged on this. In fact, ENT UK, who's the medical body representing ear, nose and throat specialists, including the president of rhinology, and if anyone's going to know about smell, it is her, have come out and urged the government to add this to the list of critical symptoms. They've done it in France.
Yeah.
They did it on March the 20th. Evidence now emerging from around the world, from Germany, from South Korea, from China, from Italy, is saying that this is a key indicator, especially if you've only had a mild case.
Interesting. So how long did it last then?
I think probably about a week. I couldn't taste or smell anything for about a week. And then it took a while for it to really reappear. And I wonder now whether it's reappeared entirely. It's hard to, you know, it's hard to remember how I used to taste and smell. It's not something that you sort of measure consciously. But I think it had gone completely for a week, and I felt pretty ropey for a week.
Yes, because they say you lose your appetite as well.
Yeah, well, I think when you can't taste or smell anything, eating is just not appealing.
No, there's not much point to it.
No, you can sort of only feel shape in your mouth, but you kind of lose the desire to eat anything.
Right.
And I was pushing food around my plate a lot, for sure.
Yeah.
But since then, my cousin who lives in London, he's lost all taste and smell. His girlfriend's lost all taste and smell. Another Brexit Party MEP is currently going through it, feeling ropey, lost all taste and smell. There's anecdotal evidence emerging everywhere that I can cannot see that this is a coincidence. It's just impossible that, you know, two-thirds of people also testing positive with coronavirus in studies that we've had from around the world have somehow magically lost taste and smell for no reason.
Yes. No, it definitely seems to be part of the whole spectrum of things that have happened and can happen to people. Because I spoke to a doctor the other day who said, oh, no, you definitely didn't have coronavirus. But, I mean, I've definitely had sort of some symptoms from time to time, you know, occasional coughing, occasional sore throat, you know, and it went on for quite a long time back in February.
Right.
But until we have these tests, which are going to be made available, we keep hearing, hopefully fairly soon, to see whether you have had it. You know, there's not much we can do, is there?
There isn't, but I do think the government need to think about really looking into this taste and smell thing. Look, if we're being so absolute in our averting risk with a lockdown and not even letting people buy Easter eggs or go to the Cotswolds, then surely we can put the message out there to people that if you completely lose your taste and smell in a way that is exceptional, not like you've just got a common cold, but in a way that is quite startling, then self-isolate. Because there must be people up and down the country who are feeling otherwise fine, maybe a bit ropey like I was, but still going about their daily life, unaware that they could be carrying this and spreading it to vulnerable people.
Well, that's why I wanted you to come on and explain what it was like, so that if there are people listening to this today and you have the same symptoms that Alex is talking about, then you must please make sure that you don't go out and about, because it may well be that you will infect people. What are you hearing from your former colleagues over in Brussels? I know not MEPs that you were in the Brexit party with, but just people that you know. Is it different over there? What's going on?
It's pretty much the same circumstances over here, to be honest. People are stuck in their houses and just trying to make the best of things. Mm. We're all in the same boat. One third of the world's on lockdown now. I think Belgium's actually doing pretty well at managing this, according to statistics.
Right.
It seems as though they're not suffering as much as, say, countries such as Spain and France and Italy. But I'd imagine, actually, I mean, I've been out of Belgium now for a fortnight, but I would imagine it's a ghost city in Brussels, because it's a city that, even at weekends, it's a ghost city when all the workers from NATO and the European Commission, the European Parliament and the lobbying firms all tend to go home at the weekends to their home nation. So I'd imagine it's a fairly quiet place.
Yes, I bet. Certainly in London is very quiet as well. But hopefully, at some point or other, we will see you back here on the other side of whatever is going on. It might be September by the looks of it, but, you know, whenever we can get together and the restaurants are open, we'll go and have lunch.
Oh, definitely, and I'll be able to taste it, which will be...
That'll be great.
Nice.
OK,
and
Alex.
Do try and collect some anecdotal evidence, because someone needs to. Someone needs to really start canvassing people on this and understanding what's going on.
Well, that's what we're going to do today, Alex. Thank you very much indeed. Alex Phillips, former Brexit Party MEP. If you know anyone, or if you are someone who has lost all sense of taste and smell, you know, let's talk about that. Let's get your views, let's get your experiences, let's get exactly what happened to you, so that we can tell everybody else. That's what we do here at Talk Radio. We're live streaming, of course, on YouTube, on Facebook and on Twitter, and we definitely need your help to be able to tell everybody what you're feeling, what you're seeing, what you're hearing, and what is going on in your neck of the woods. 0344 499 1000. This is Talk Radio.
Mid-morning with Mike Graham. Talk Radio.
Now, many of you have been tweeting me about various things. Many people on social media have been reporting people being arrested. We saw the Derbyshire police, I think it was last week, sending up a drone to point out that too many people were going to a particular beauty spot, walking their dogs in what appeared to be a relatively clear and empty place to do it in the Peak District. Let's talk to Ken Marsh from the Metropolitan Police Federation to find out whether there is any actual kind of uniform instruction out there, if you'll pardon the pun. Ken, a very good morning to you.
Morning, Mike.
Thanks very much for joining us. Is it a problem for the different individual, you know, police forces in the country because there's no specific instruction on what they're supposed to be policing?
Well, there is clear legislation that's been rolled out by the government. It was rolled out about 2.5 days ago, and we are getting to grips with that. It is quite concise what the legislation is. It's how you put it into practice is clearly going to be a challenge for us. And, you know, I have a large metropolitan area where I have completely different dynamics and demographics to, as you were talking about before, the Peak Districts, etc. We don't have anything like that. So it's how each force interprets where we are, what we're doing, and how we're going to do it. But, you know, I would add, and I'll say this quite honestly, Mike, it's very good having all these sofa solicitors who have suddenly appeared. They've got every facade of how we're meant to do something.
Right.
My brave colleagues are out there right now. They don't want to be doing this.
Mm.
They would like to be 2 metres plus from every single person, like we're being told to be. So
yeah,
please bear that in mind.
No, I think that's a very good point, and I'm glad you made it. But I think we ought to be able to be specific about what, for example, is an essential product. If you're out buying stuff and the police are going to start going through your bag, most people, first of all, will be edgy about that. And second of all, it would be more helpful, I think, if the government or some organisation or maybe even the police said, you know, these are what are considered essential products. Because we've got Grant Shapps today telling people, go to the supermarket once a week, buy the big shop, and then don't go back for another week. On the other hand, you've got the supermarket saying you can only have three of everything.
Right. Well, I'm not aware that's within the legislation as to what you can and can't buy. So that's the first thing. And I'm not aware of police officers in the Met going through people's bags, having a look at what they're buying. There's a lot of media out there that isn't quite correct, because my colleagues that I'm talking to are not doing that at all, looking through people's bags. We're asking for common sense here, Mike. We're asking for, you know, let's all come together here and work out what is right or wrong. You know what you need in terms of provisions. It's not for us to tell you that, for goodness sake.
Yeah, but I mean, would you say to me, would you say an Easter egg is an essential item?
Well, that was nothing to do with the police, what you're talking about.
What do you mean?
See, again, the police were nothing to do with the whole media thing about Easter eggs.
Well, what was it to do with then?
The police. It was, I believe, environmental health officers.
Okay. Well, what are they doing getting involved in it?
I've no idea, but it wasn't.
Maybe you should arrest them instead.
This is what I'm saying to you. We need to understand what is right and what is wrong and how we move forward with this, because, you know, it is difficult. It is challenging. We're not always going to get it right as cops, but we're doing our damnedest.
Yes. I mean, certainly one thing that I have seen, which is I'm sure you've seen, is that police officer in Golders Green who was handing out a fine to a woman who was trying to draw some chalk lines on the pavement in order to safeguard her customers. And he was insisting that, well, you know, the laws don't change just because something else is going on. Otherwise, it'd be anarchy.
Yeah. Well, what I would say to you on that one, Mike, I'm not going to criticise one of my colleagues, because I know the full scenario of it. And if that officer had the correct, you know, legislation put in front, the correct training package, I believe they have about a 25-minute learning package on a computer screen. You know, it's very, very easy to finite individual things. Now, when that was looked at afterwards, it was dealt with correctly. It was changed, the decision, and we moved forward from it. And the lady actually fully understood the sentiment of what was happening.
Mm-hmm.
So I get where you're coming from, and I get the public, but the media are making such a furore of things that, you know, it works both ways. My cops, and I've said it over and over again, are not going to get it right every time straight away. But they're human beings. Please, bear with us. We're doing it for one reason, and that's to save lives.
Sure, I get all that. But the point is, I'm not criticising individual police officers or individual forces. What I am saying is, would it not be more helpful to everyone if there was a clear definition? I mean, you've said to me, everybody knows what an essential item is. Well, actually, we don't. Not everybody knows what an essential item is, because what if you want to go out and buy yourself, I don't know, a set of curtains? Is that an essential item? I don't know.
I get what you're saying, and I do understand the sentiment of what you're saying. I'm not trying to prick you at all, but this is for the government to make clear. You know, if we're talking,
I think that's kind of what I think that's kind of the point I'm making. It's not your fault if you don't know what the guidelines are.
No, I get that totally, and I'm with you fully. What is essential? Your essentials might not be my essentials, and, you know, we should go on and on round and round the houses. But again, with the same sentiment, I think it would be very difficult to draw up a list of what is essentials. I think they're asking for the public to use a bit of common sense here, but I get your sentiment.
Yeah, I mean, I guess if something's on sale in a supermarket, you should be able to buy it if you're allowed to go to the supermarket.
I don't, you know, it's a real difficult one, because, as I say, you know, your essential could not be my essential. You might not eat what I eat. You know, there's huge facets to it. But I think what they're trying
to say... Well, surely any kind of food is an essential, isn't it?
Well, is any kind? You just highlighted Easter eggs. Are they essential? I suppose if you ask my wife.
Yeah. If you've got children who are locked in a house and who can't do anything, I think you're allowed to buy them an Easter egg, aren't you?
Yeah, I've said it already today. I'm not the food police, and I'm not here to judge what people can and can't buy. But I think, as you quite rightly point out, we need guidelines, very clear guidelines, and at the moment we haven't got those in relation to what we should and shouldn't be doing around who's purchasing what.
Yeah, I mean, Neil Basu today, the assistant commissioner of the Met, has written in the Telegraph that our police officers must preserve the trust and confidence of the public and maintain the tradition of policing by consent. So he seems to be suggesting that he doesn't want officers to get a bit carried away.
Quite right, and I totally agree, and I've said that over and over again. But in the same breath, you know, this is absolutely never been done before, what we're doing. You know, we're asking cops around the country to go out and enforce something they haven't really got their heads around properly. They haven't had time to digest, have stated cases, to understand it. You know, everything that goes with legislation. So, again, and I get the sentiment of Mr. Basu, but please bear with us because we are trying to do the best for what he's put in front of us.
It sounds to me like you would not be able to make this policing of this kind of social distancing any harder, as it were. You know, if suddenly the government came out this week and said, right, we've still got a problem, too many people are still going out, too many people are not doing what we're asking them to do, so now we're going to enforce it. It sounds to me like the police would be difficult for you guys.
It would be very difficult. I mean, you've seen in other European countries that they have certification approved why they're out and what they're doing. I mean, we are so different from every other country in the world, really, where we've always policed by consent and we've always, you know, had the public with us, so to speak. We're not by force. So it is very, very difficult. I get that totally. But we need to do something because I think it's starting to prove already that by social distancing, we will reduce the numbers.
Yeah, I agree with all that. And what about the stories that have been written that the police, because of this action they're having to take, are now having to kind of ignore small crimes and other things that they might otherwise be investigating?
No, I don't go along with that at all. You couldn't show me any evidence base on that. My colleagues are still doing their 24/7 job that they've been doing all along, and I haven't seen any statistical facts around the fact that we're doing less in certain areas. Actually, crime has gone down and the calls into policing has gone down since this happened, so I haven't seen that.
OK, and some people are tweeting me saying, please ask your guests whether it's right that the police officers are out with speed cameras on some of the roads.
Well, you just answered your own question because normal policing is taking place as well as what we're doing in relation to COV19. So, you know, we are policing. I can't say specific departments what they're doing, but policing is policing and it's happening as we speak.
Yes, but I think the point that this guy's making is if there's any essential vehicles on the road, why would you be giving them tickets?
Again, I'm not aware of what you're talking about or where it is. I'm not aware that tickets are being issued for speeding or are they being stopped to ask where they're going. You know, you're throwing something up on a radio. I have no knowledge of whatsoever, so I can't really comment on something.
Yeah. I can tell you I got a ticket the other day for going up a one-way street the wrong way, which I didn't know was a one-way street because the sign was so high that I was looking for a parking spot around Guy's Hospital and I was given a ticket by Southwark Council. Not a police matter, but obviously that's not very helpful.
Okay.
Hey?
Okay.
Well, it's not, is it? I mean, you know, we're working in an emergency here. We're working in a crisis.
Yep.
Handing out tickets of 130 quid to somebody for going up a residential, quiet, one-way street doesn't seem to me to be the way to get the public on side.
Okay, well, that's the council you're talking about.
Yes, it is.
So I can't speak on behalf of the council.
No, I'm not asking you to. I'm just saying that's the kind of thing that annoys people.
Yeah, no, I understand what you're saying. And, you know, my empathy goes to you.
Thank
in
you.
Relation to that.
Thank you very much, Ken. You're very kind. I'll let you know if I manage to get off it or not.
All right,
mate. We'll see. Ken Marsh, thank you very much indeed. Chair of the Metropolitan Police Federation. If you're out there and about, I'd like to hear from you because you are our eyes and ears. You can tell me if there are speed cameras operational, tell me where they are. If there are people giving out tickets and fines for things, tell me where that's happening. Because obviously, Ken's right. We don't just want anecdotal information. We want real information. And certainly one we saw in Golders Green, by the sounds of it, has all been done away with. And the woman has now not been given a ticket for what she was doing. So that's good news. But, you know, clearly And I have some sympathy for the police because, you know, if they're not being told what it is that the limitations are of people buying stuff, going out and getting stuff, then they're not going to have an idea. But what we don't want is these overzealous characters basically rubbing their hands together and going, oh, this will be good. We'll find some people. 0344 499 1000 is the number. We'll take your calls next.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Getting caught in the wrong shoes can interrupt your plans for the day. Like when that 10% chance of rain ends up looking more like 100%. When the transition to fall and winter feels more like experiencing every season on the same day, there's the Allbirds Mizzle Collection. These shoes were made for misty morning walks, surprise snow days, and anything a trip to the dog park might bring. The whole collection brings together water-repellent technology and classic style, so you can stay warm, dry, and comfy during your everyday adventures. Cross off errands with the splash protection on the Wool Runner Mizzle. Dash through cold and wet weather with all-conditioned traction and reflective details on the Wool Dasher Mizzle. Or upgrade to next-level protection with the Mud Guard on the Wool Runner-Up Mizzle Plus. Go to allbirds.com and use code FRESHSOCKS for a free pair of socks with your purchase. ALLBIRDS.com, code FRESHSOCKS.
Mid-morning with Mike Graham. Talk Radio.
Welcome back to the Independent Republic of Mike Graham. I'm delighted to say that we're now about to speak to Patrick Moore, who's the voluntary chair of the CO2 Coalition in Washington, D.C., former founder, or co-founder, I should say, of Greenpeace. Patrick, welcome to Talk Radio.
Thanks for having me on, Mike.
Thanks very much indeed. We've been wanting to talk to you for a long time about a whole series of things, really, and I'm really glad we've now got the opportunity to do so. But I guess we'd have to start off with what is going on around the world with coronavirus and how terribly it's affecting the economies of the world and the people of the world. What's your take on it, and what do you see happening in the coming sort of weeks?
I think the panic around this virus has something to do with the climate catastrophe panic. I think that the social media has got people in such a state these days that they you'd think it was World War III.
Yeah.
It's terrible to see people die, but then we're all going to die. I'm not afraid of that. And if you look at the cost of what's going on here in terms of just shutting down the whole economies. This was not done during other pandemics. And in many of those, there were actually more losses. It is a case of walking and chewing gum. There's no doubt about it. You have to try to do two things at once. And that's not always easy.
No, I think so. I think the problem for a lot of governments of the world is that they've started off from a sort of slightly lower plane. And then as time has gone on, you know, things have kind of exacerbated themselves and things have increased in numbers. And the numbers certainly do seem to be increasing. And I think we're now seeing perhaps what we didn't see before, which is some people dying who would otherwise not have died.
Yes, it of course, it's such an unknown that you can understand why people even overreact to such a thing. We don't know what the outcome is going to be. We do know now that these medications that are being corroborated as to their effectiveness, many health workers are now using this Hydro-Q substance, which is unpronounceable, so I just call it Hydro-Q.
Hydro-Q is good for me. This is the anti-malaria drug, right?
Yes, it is. And there's others, too. And they're antiviral drugs, basically, malaria not being a virus. But But they are active against viruses, and they seem to be having a good effect, especially as a prophylactic for health workers to prevent them from getting the infection in the first place. Once you have the infection, though, they also seem to be efficacious in some instances. So anything that works. And so people who are criticizing this, I don't understand their brains.
Yes, I saw that you tweeted out earlier today that the FDA, which is the Food and Drug Administration, has issued an emergency use authorization. So I guess that would be a step in the right direction.
Yes, it is. But the mainstream media is still blaming Trump for using scant evidence to push this thing as if it's some kind of quackery, when in fact there are many medical doctors around the world in China, France, Italy, and the United States who are saying it has some effectiveness.
Yes. Well, I mean, the mainstream media in general blames Donald Trump for pretty much everything, of course. And you also have a situation where many of the mainline scientists, one famously in London, Imperial College, has had to re-evaluate his original kind of worst case scenario, which was 500,000 dead people in Britain, to around about 20,000.
Yes, well, but in the United States, it's jumped up pretty badly, and I can understand. I see now that that Trump has said April 30th we'll have to continue distancing in the U.S.
Yes,
and we're certainly. I'm from Canada, of course, and we're certainly practicing that here all across the country. And I think that's a good idea. I just wonder if we should have shut things down so much, because you can social distance and still work.
Yes, I think perhaps because we were trying to sort of fight all the attacks coming from all sides at the same time, there was a strategy certainly used in this country where if you'd said to me a month ago, Patrick, you know, this is where we're going to be, I wouldn't have believed you. And I probably wouldn't have been an enthusiastic supporter of it. But now that we are here, I think we all have realised. I mean, I'm finding myself distancing myself from people on the street that I wouldn't have done just a week ago, you know? So it's almost like your attitude changes with the news, if you like.
I think that's called rolling with the punches. And as I say, because it's so unknown, you have no other choice. This is real time. We don't have a crystal ball, and we've got to just go with the flow here. And I think right now caution is in order.
Sure. What do you make of the figures coming out of China? Because there's been some controversy this week where people are suggesting that the Chinese haven't entirely been honest about the numbers.
Well, I can't see how it dropped off a cliff like that. That hasn't happened anywhere else.
Hmm.
They were reporting thousands and then suddenly it's tens. So I don't know, though. I have no personal knowledge of this. I've read the reports. It sounds pretty fishy that it could. It hasn't ended like that anywhere else that I know of.
No, that's right. And as you say, it's such an unknown. The whole area is an unknown. And there are probably very good reasons why people who are not scientists and who are not epidemiologists should give their views on what it is that we should be doing. Because I've said to people before that even in Germany, where it's said to be working quite well, the measures they're taking, we still don't really know if it's any better than the measures we're taking because we haven't finished yet.
That's correct. And in the end, we will have learned a lot from this at some cost, unfortunately. But these viruses and all of the diseases, they have evolution, too, and they can actually evolve faster than we can.
Yeah.
And we just have to face the fact that they exist in this world's environment and learn from each episode and try to find the vaccines, which is amazing that we can do such a thing. Not many other animals can make a vaccine against the disease that is wiping them out. So here we are in this time in history with such tremendous technology and medicine and advances happening all the time. I still think I'm totally grateful that I live in this world.
Yes, I think so. And your Twitter feed has science and logic, not sensation and fear, as one of the messages to people. And something that you and I would have talked about more before this all happened was the whole climate change argument and the craziness of the people who want to change the way that we live. Some people are saying now, well, they've all got what they wanted. You know, Extinction Rebellion have got exactly what they wanted. Nobody's going anywhere. Nobody's flying anywhere. You know, the world is already a greener place.
Yeah, that's great. That's a nice definition of green, all kinds of people dying. Well, Extinction Rebellion is the epitome of this toxic mixture of far-left politics and religious cult.
Yeah.
all dressed up in those same weird-looking uniforms that are somewhat halfway between the Inquisition and Star Trek or something.
Yeah, it's weird that they all like the uniform.
That's just bonkers, and it's destroying a lot of young people's minds.
Hmm.
It's really a serious, terrible shame. Just 2 points. It's colder now during this Pleistocene ice age with the sheets of ice covering both poles than it has been for 260 million years since the last ice age, which was called the Karoo. Look it up.
Mm.
Everything I say can be corroborated in about 5 minutes with Google. The other thing is CO2 has been lower during this era of the Pleistocene ice age than ever in the history of the Earth or ever in the history of life on Earth. It went down to 180 ppm during the last glaciation, which is only 30 ppm above the death of plants. Human CO2 emissions are actually beneficial in that we have restored a balance to the global carbon cycle. Read my stuff, watch my videos. This is the correct interpretation of what is happening on planet Earth today. And you have to look back more than 150 years to see the patterns of climate and climate change and temperature and CO2 and all the other variables. And it is just a terrible shame that people are being brainwashed
and
thinking that the end is coming because of CO2 and because it's too hot, when in fact the planet is at the coldest it's been for a quarter of a billion years.
Well, one of the things that annoys me about this whole argument that they make is that they basically come out with statements like, you know, the science is clear, the scientific consensus is absolutely right, to which I always say, well, there was a time when most of the people living on Earth thought the Earth was flat. That means consensus means absolutely nothing, doesn't it?
Consensus is not a science term. It is a political term, meaning more people agree on something than don't.
Right.
And that's a good thing. That's democracy. But the fact of the matter is, in science, it only takes one person to make an important discovery, and that's how nearly all of them have been made.
Yeah.
You don't have 2,000 scientists all suddenly finding out the theory of relativity or the theory of evolution or the theory of light or the theory of electricity.
Mm.
That happens with Faraday's and Mendel's and Einstein's and Newton's, you know, and Darwin's. Those are individual people who made those discoveries. And that's the same thing about science today. It's not about consensus. It is about facts.
Yes.
And the facts have been completely garbled and politicized, and science has gone right out the window. You cannot say the science is settled on something so complicated. I'm in the middle of writing a new book called Fake Invisible Catastrophes and Threats of Doom. And the real problem with so many of the scare stories today, they are based on things that are either invisible or so remote, like polar bears and coral reefs, that no member of the public can verify for themselves by observation what the activists and politicians and media and scientists in the pay of the government to make these sensations, they can't verify these things.
Well, they didn't
and
say...
So CO2 is the classic one. You can't point in the corner and say, look what the CO2 is doing over there to the climate,
right?
Because it's invisible.
Mm.
And no scientist has actually been able to tweeze out in an empirical way, like in direct measurement, what percentage of the greenhouse effect is due to CO2 compared to water and the other greenhouse gases. It's a very complex subject because, as I say, these things are invisible and they are a moving target.
Yeah, well, they certainly didn't see the coronavirus coming. And let me finish up, Patrick, with one last question. Do you fear that the politicians and the climate change nutters will actually try and use what's happening now to change the way that we live?
They'll use anything. They act as though we're in desperate times, when in fact we're in the best time in the history of human civilization. This coronavirus will be seen as a blip, a nasty one, yes, but it will be over and life will go on. And I don't believe that they will have a big effect in the final analysis. The problem is we're in the modern warm period, and it's scheduled, according to the last few thousands of years of cycles, to go on for another 200 years before we would go back into something like the Little Ice Age again. And everybody thinks that's all over and that we're in a new era and that the whole North Pole is going to become tropical again or something. That is not in the cards by any history that there is in this in the history of climate. It's just not in the cards.
Okay. Patrick Moore, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you, Mike.
Coming up later in the show, we'll be going to homeschooling time, of course, as well, because we want to go to a place called Eam, where Mrs. Fran Clifford is going to join us. It was known as the Village of the Damned, because while we're in the midst of this coronavirus crisis, you know, I think it was probably a bit worse back in the days of the bubonic plague, and we'll find out where the final case of that happened way back in the 17th century. This is Talk Radio. We'll take loads of your calls coming up next as well. 0344 499 1000. This is the Independent Republic of Mike Graham.
Mid-morning with Mike Graham. Talk Radio. The Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
Welcome back to the Independent Republic of Mike Graham right here on Talk Radio. Coming up at 1 o'clock, it's Ian Collins and it's Kevin O'Sullivan. Coming up right now, though, it is time for our homeschooling section, which is proving to be very successful. Lots of people are really enjoying it. If you haven't got your children around the radio just yet, well, please do so, because we're about to talk to a fascinating woman about a fascinating story. Mrs. Fran Clifford from the Eam Museum joins us now, because Eam, for those of you who have never heard of it, was known as the Village of the Damned, because on the 1st of November 1666, farm worker Abraham Morton gasped his final breath, and he was the last of 260 people to die from bubonic plague in that particular village, which is in Derbyshire. Let's talk to Fran Clifford right now. Fran, a very good afternoon to you. Welcome.
Good afternoon.
Thank you so much for joining us. Now, we've been doing this homeschooling thing to help parents who are trying to teach their kids at home, because partly just to give them a break, really, from some of the stuff that they're having to do. And I wasn't aware of this story at all, I must admit. I mean, I'm feeling slightly ignorant about not knowing. But the first thing I learned was how to pronounce it, because some people pronounce it Iam and some people pronounce it Eam. So I'm told Eam is correct. Is
that right? Locals pronounce it Eam.
Oh, Eam, OK. So the Y is kind of silent.
Pardon?
The Y is a sort of silent Y.
Yes.
Oh, OK. So exactly how big is Eam, or Eam?
Well, it's, at the moment, it's about, it's not a very big, it's a very small village, about 900 inhabitants.
OK.
At the time of the plague, there would be about 750 inhabitants. Fewer houses than now, but more densely populated.
Yes, right. And what exactly was the illness that caused Eam to be quarantined? And we're talking about sort of back in the 17th century now, aren't we?
Yes, we're talking about 1665.
OK.
But the illness was bubonic plague, which had raged up and down Europe since the Black Death in the 14th century.
Yeah.
Yeah, and
it wasn't a great time to be alive, really, was it?
No, it was part of the second pandemic.
Mm.
The Black Death being in the first pandemic and then the second pandemic.
Yes. And is it right that it got spread to Eam because of a bale of cloth that came from London?
Well, they think it was tailor's materials that he'd ordered from London. Yes.
Right. Okay.
They took delivery of the cloth that came from London, which is 160 miles away.
Mm.
And when it arrived, it was unpacked by the tailor's assistant, and he found it to be damp, so he hung it up to dry.
Right.
And within a short time, he was very ill with the symptoms of the plague, but they didn't recognise it at that. He died in September 1666, probably a week or so later, buried in the churchyard.
Right.
Unfortunately, within the next 3 weeks, there were five more deaths, all within neighbouring houses, four houses. And people began to put two and two together.
Right.
And think that it was the plague. And then their thoughts were confirmed when the following month there were 23 deaths.
Goodness.
Which meant that within under 2 months there were 29 deaths, which was the annual average figure for the whole of year.
And I imagine it must have been very frightening because, of course, we are now so used to kind of 24-hour television, radio, you know, the internet. Back then, they probably didn't even know what was happening.
Well, they knew about plague because it had broken out intermittently right through the ages. But they had... it was a killer disease. They didn't know... it was unknown how... it was very highly infectious, but it was unknown how the infection was transmitted. They'd no reliable cure. They relied on herbal remedies. The most popular treatment was to get the buboes, which were the tumours that formed in the lymph glands, almost at the end of their disease, before they died, was to draw off the pus, the infected matter from the lumps, before it entered the bloodstream and prevent the onset of gangrene, which, of course, would lead to sepsis.
Yes.
It was a very, very nasty disease.
So if you got it, there wasn't really any two ways about how it was going to end. You were basically going to die.
There were very, very few survivors, stories of people that survived after having caught it.
Yes. And so did people get quarantined in those days then?
Well, then... That was the only way that they had of getting it to stop it spreading outside the village. At the beginning of the plague, when it was first realised what it was, the more wealthy and more influential people in the village would have fled. They would have had somewhere to go to, and they would have had the means to maintain their families, and they would have left the village.
Right.
We think probably about a third of the population, which left two-thirds of the population in the village itself.
And it became known as the Village of the Damned, which is very... I suppose romantic is not the right word, but it's a very dramatic sort of name, isn't it?
Yeah, but they thought that if they prayed very hard and kept themselves to themselves within the village, that the Derbyshire winters would kill the plague off.
Yes.
And, in fact, the numbers did drop. But by the end of the eighth month, by the end of April, there were some 70 people had died of plague. But they did know that, or they thought was, that... if they could get a period of 21 days, 3 weeks to a month without anybody getting the infection, their prayers had been answered. And that happened in May. There were no deaths from plague in May.
So not that different in a way from the approach that we're seeing today with the coronavirus, where the government is hopeful that if the numbers drop and they finally stop getting infected, then we'll be seeing our way out of this.
Yes, well, their celebrations were short-lived because by June, when the warmer weathering came, more and more people were beginning to be ill. And then it was then that the the rector of the village, in the absence of the squire and the wealthy residents of the village, the next choice for... somebody making decisions about their action was with the parson.
Right.
And William Mompesson was the rector. He was a young man. He'd only been here less than 12 months. And in the village was also his predecessor, an older man called Thomas Stanley, who was a Puritan priest. And although they had religious differences, they met together and they realised that the disease was going to get... things were going to get a lot worse before they got better.
Yes.
And they realised also that if people fled the village, they would spread it to other villages.
So were the sort of surrounding areas relatively plague-free then?
Well, they were all plague-free. Wow. There wasn't any outbreak at all.
That's amazing. That really is amazing, because you could do that in those days, but not so much here, I suppose.
Yeah, well, it is a bacterial disease, and it's much easier to contain the bacterial disease, so you can't contain a virus.
Right. So the last person to die of the bubonic plague at that time was in this village?
Well, it was on the outskirts of the village. One person writes that there was nobody died after the middle of October.
Right.
But there are records of people having been died, but I think that was the record of when the bodies were found and they were buried.
Right. So fascinating story. And your museum there in Eme, I mean, I'm not sure how I would feel. I mean, it's a bit like when you find people who want to move to a particular house and then they discover that there was a murder in the house and they don't want to live there anymore, you know. So, I mean, do people move to Eme worry about the fact that this has got the history of the village of the damned?
No, I don't know. I think they're attracted because of the village. But it's a funny thing when you come to live here. I've only lived here 36 years. So
okay.
I was not born.
Is there a local pub?
There is only one left now. Yes, there were quite a lot, but the local pub. Can I just say that when the two men set aside all their religious differences, they decided to show a united front, and they came up with a plan to save people outside the village and also to limit the amount of infection within the village. And these were radical decisions.
Right.
One was the quarantine, no one in and no one out. And then they closed the church because they realised that they could be passing on in an enclosed area as an assembly of people could pass on the disease. But the most radical was they decided no funerals.
Ah, interesting.
Because when the victim died, they believed that the infection was released into the atmosphere and so reinfected all the village and put them more at risk. And so they were asked that when their loved ones died, they had to bury them immediately themselves in their own back gardens, in the fields at the back of the house or in the water, anywhere where they could do that.
What a story. It really is remarkable. And I'm so glad that we got to speak to you, Fran, because, you know, I think a lot of people will be listening to this thinking, we didn't know about that. That's amazing. So people can come and visit your museum, presumably.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, not now, but when things return to normal.
No, it's closed at the moment.
No, you can't spread any coronavirus up in Eme. They've had enough. The history has been poor enough to them.
But the community is always pulled together.
Yes.
They've had all their differences pulled together, and the community spirit now and the way people are looking after anybody that's at risk and inquiring after is amazing.
Yes. Well, you know, we're a very resilient people, Fran, partly because of something that happened back in the 17th century.
Yeah.
Fran Clifford, thank you so much for talking to us from the Eme Museum up in Derbyshire, the village of the damned, right? I think that's a fascinating story. I'm amazed nobody's made a film out of it, really, to be honest. Maybe somebody has. Maybe somebody can tell me. But coming up, we've got some more time in the show to take some more of your calls. 0344 499 1000 is the number. This is Talk Radio.
Talk Radio. Across the UK. Online. On DAB. And on your smart speaker. The Independent Republic of Mike Graham. On Talk Radio.
If you enjoyed that, be sure to catch the whole show 10 to 1, Monday to Friday, on Talk Radio via DAB online or via the Talk Radio app. And if you have an opinion on the stories we cover, we'd love to hear from you. Call us on 0344 499 1000 or tweet at Talk Radio during the show to have your say.
Mid-morning with Mike Graham. Talk Radio.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers, with rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com. Code PROGRAM.